The scripture reading tonight will be Job chapter 1, verses 6 through 12. Job chapter 1, verses 6 through 12. I'll be reading from the New American Standard Update. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. Put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him." So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. That's Job 1, 6 through 12.
Thank you, Randy, for reading that for us. As we look at this passage that was read just a moment ago by Randy, we certainly know that suffering is the common plight of all men. And I don't know that any of us have ever had anything to even come close with the sufferings of Job. Now, as we talk about Job, it's going to be, an interesting, almost said fascinating study because of who Job is and some of the things that relate to his argumentation. There is no experience, I suppose, that's any more universal in our lives than that of suffering. There are all kinds of sources that we might suffer from. We might suffer from some calamity of nature. We may suffer from some wound that other men inflict upon us. And we talked in our study last time about some of the possible sources of that. And we might suffer because of something that is self-inflicted, either willfully or maybe even in ignorance. But one thing is sure, that we all suffer. Now, our question before I get to the screen, is what do we do in times of suffering? I think that's crucial. How do we handle suffering when it occurs? And I know, and you do too, we've had discussions with folks that do not believe in God. They do not believe in the Bible. Because their question is, how can an omnipotent, omniscient, loving God tolerate the evils that go on in the world in which we live? And how can such human suffering be a part of the scheme of man if such a God exists? Now, one fellow put it like this, and I think he's worded the question correctly. He said, if God is willing to prevent evil but not able, then he is impotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he is a criminal. Is he both able and willing? Then whence comes evil? And that's right. When we look at the characteristics of God and the presence of evil in the world and suffering that we all endure from time to time, we raise the question, why? Have you ever asked that? Maybe known somebody that was enduring some terrible times, and we raise that question. Why? Why me? Well, I want us to notice that as we consider Job and its place in the books of the Bible, that becomes the subject matter that's being discussed. Why is there suffering, and how do we handle that when it comes along? Now, in some Bible classes in times gone by, we've studied most of us in school what's called the books of poetry, or when I was in school, it was called the wisdom literature. And we generally group together Psalms, or Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. And one fellow, Oswald Chambers, who lived a long time ago, summarized these books like this: how to suffer, how to pray, how to act, how to enjoy, and in the Song of Solomon, how to love. And I suppose, just in brief, that's about as good a summary as we know how to give to these books of wisdom or books of poetry. Now, I want to put this chart on the board for a reason. These are introductory remarks as we get into a contextual study of the book of Job. And when we consider the book of Job as a book of poetry, as you read it, that's what it is. It is a long book of poetry. And you say, well, it don't rhyme and have the rhythm and all of that that our poetry. Well, there are different kinds of poetry, and I'm not a poet. But that's how the book is generally considered, as a book of wisdom or among the books of poetry. And you'll see that as you read. And sometimes in the kind of poetry that is in the book of Job, it reads rather difficult. Now, I ask you to make an attempt to read the book of Job this afternoon. Some of you, as Bruce has indicated, did try to do that. And I dare say that it became a challenge, because some of the same things are said over and over and over and over, both by those who were considered as friends of Job and by Job himself, as he repeats the same thing over and over. One fellow even used the word monotonous to describe the book of Job, because just in the reading of it, you see the same thing. I wouldn't want to use a word quite that strong, but that's the idea, that things are repeated over and over and over. Now, as we've noted, the real question in all of this, in our study of the book of Job, is what do we do when we suffer? Is there something that we can learn about how to suffer from the book of Job? And to answer that, yes. What use shall we make of it when we ask the question, why? Now, we studied in our study last Lord's Day evening from Psalms chapter 73 and noted that the psalmist is raising the question, essentially the same question that we consider from time to time, why me? When I look round about and I see other folks and they're not good people, they're doing bad things, and yet things seem to be going well for them, and then here I am, I'm trying to do what's right and things are not going so well for me. And Asaph said that I didn't understand. It was too painful for me until I went into the house of the Lord and I saw the latter end. And when he saw the latter end, then he saw that there's some things to be gleaned and learned from the way that he was living his life. Now, I want to deal with this. I wanted to deal with that specifically, as you see on the screen. Why did this happen to me? I don't know the times that folks have asked that of me. Why me? Why did this happen to me? Well, that's really the question that Asaph is asking in Psalm 73. Why me? Now, let me pose another question. I want you to think about it. Why not me? What makes me so unique that I can live my life independent of the things that smite other people? Why not me? Now, see, that was the issue that Satan is approaching God on regarding Job. Why not Job? He's over here, things are going great for Job. Why doesn't he suffer all these? Well, the reason is, God, you've built a hedge around him so that he can't be reached. Now, the language that is used in that text is interesting to me, because that was typical during times gone by for folks to build a hedge, that is a thorny hedge around a piece of property that they wanted to protect. The thorny hedge would keep the bad folks on the other side, don't you see? Now, that's what Satan is arguing. You built a hedge around him so that he can't be reached. Well, now, why not Job? See, that's the question Satan is asking. Why not Job suffer some things? God said, all right. You just go after Job. You take away everything that he owns. And so then we read in the first chapter, following the verses that were read in our hearing just a moment ago, beginning in verse 13, of all of the calamities that Job began to suffer, independent of his own flesh. And still we know that Job remained faithful to God and maintained his integrity. And then Satan was permitted to afflict Job's body with boils from the top of his head to the sole of his foot. And still in all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. Now, what we want to look at is this question. Some say, well, why did this happen to me? Have you ever had anybody say, well, that's just the Lord's will? Some terrible calamity come into somebody's life. I've listened to folks try to comfort somebody that had lost a child by saying, well, that's just the Lord's will. Now, that's foolishness. You see, the Lord didn't bring devastating things into your life. Don't blame Him. That was the dilemma that Job had. He was suffering all of these horrible things, and he didn't understand the justice in all of that, because he had lived a righteous life. In our last study, we looked at this passage in Luke chapter 13 and in verse 16 about Jesus healing this woman on the Sabbath day. And we know that this woman was bowed and had been for a very long time. And Jesus said that, why not release her from this bondage whom Satan hath bound, lo, these many years. Now, what was the source of her suffering? Well, it wasn't God. God didn't make her that way. So it wasn't the will of the Lord that she be messed up like that for so long. And when you look at Paul's thorn in the flesh in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, you'll notice that he had seen some magnificent things. The text tells us that he was carried up into the third heaven. But the Lord allowed him to bear what's referred to as a messenger from Satan. Now look at that. The thorn in the flesh. I don't know what it was, and you don't either. But we know where it came from. God allowed it, yes, but what was the source of it? It's described as a messenger from Satan. Now, when we look at why did this happen to me, and some say, well, it's the Lord's will. Don't go that route. No, that's not the direction we want to go. We want to see the source of evil. Now, when we began to read, and we didn't study this in our last study, but one of the things that I do want you to be aware of is that God sometimes brought evil upon His people by means of punishing them for things they did. And you can read about that in 1 Kings chapter 10. 1 Kings chapter 10, where God identified that He was going to bring the host of the Assyrians upon the Israelites and punish them. That's not the passage I'm looking for. I thought maybe 2 Kings chapter 10. Let me look right quick. Well, I'll have to find it. 2 Kings. Let me get on the right page. Well, I'm not finding it readily. It's on the left-hand page, Richard, on the right-hand column, about halfway down. That one. Well, I'll have to find that. I thought I had it in my notes, but I do, and I'll have to look for it. But God had said that He was going to bring up the Assyrians that would be the instrument of His wrath. And then He was going to bring up the Babylonians because the king of Assyria would claim credit for all of the things that he had done. And of course, the context of that indicates that God would use the king of Assyria to bring His wrath upon His people. But again, we want to note just here that when you're sick or somebody you know is sick or lost a loved one or something to that effect, that we can't say, well, it's the Lord's will that all these bad things have happened. That's not so. Now, when we want to turn to the book of Job, introductory material, typically we want to know, well, who wrote it? Where was it written from? And about what time was it written? And you're going to notice on that kind of thing, I've got I don't know on the board a whole lot of time because I don't. You might say, well, why even bother dealing with that? Well, we've got to identify something about it as we begin to try to identify the background of the book. There are a lot of people that have different views on who wrote the book of Job. Some say, well, Moses wrote it. Others attribute it, strangely enough, to Elihu, one of the last major characters in the book. Others attribute it to Elijah. And some weighty arguments are made to date the book around the time of Solomon and even attribute its authorship to Solomon, Hezekiah, Jeremiah, a whole bunch of folks. Bottom line, I don't know who wrote it, and you don't either. When was it written? Well, when you look at the wide variety of supposed authors or possible authors of the book, you see also a wide variety of dating of when these men lived, all the way from Moses all the way up to as late as 4th century B.C. when you get up into the time of Hezekiah and even beyond that a little bit. We see that there's a wide range of about 1,000 years separating the earliest dates from the later dates. So I don't know when the book was written. But you know, there's some important questions that we need to ask about that. Relative to the book itself, is it the product of one mind or is there a variety of authors that compose the book? Well, now don't answer and say, well, it's from one mind, God revealed it. Well, that's true. We know that. But as far as who penned it, I don't know who penned it. Is it all one unit, or was it written at different times? There are those who believe that the speeches of Job's friends were associated with one time frame, and then the things that Elihu is recorded to have said come along a little bit later. All of that, we've got to say that in introducing the book, but the thing that is important is that Job lived, and that the book is inspired of God. And when you begin to deal with the history of the book and the background, you don't miss that. With all the things that we don't know, we do know that Job lived. He was indeed a historical character. Turn in your Bible to the Old Testament book of Ezekiel, and I want to call your attention to who Ezekiel was. Ezekiel was one of the younger captives that were taken by the Babylonians. Ezekiel, along with Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now you know that Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had positions of authority in the Babylonian kingdom. Ezekiel did not. Ezekiel was just a common Israelite. He was a prophet, but he was one of the commoners that was taken captive by the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. Now in Ezekiel's writing, in the 14th chapter, reading beginning at verse 12, look at your Bible. It says, "And the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, when a land sinneth against me by committing a trespass, and I stretch out my hand upon it, and break the staff of the bread thereof, and send famine upon it, and cut off from it man and beast, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, saith the Lord Jehovah." Now what do we know about Noah, Daniel, and Job? Ezekiel tells us that they were righteous. Now how would Job be identified by Ezekiel as a righteous man if indeed he was not as much of a real character as the others that are mentioned? Well, Job lived. Ezekiel said he did. And we know that Job lived, and we know that the book of Job is recognized as authentic, as James writes in James chapter 5, reading beginning in verse 10. He said, "Take, brethren, for an example of suffering and of patience, the prophets who spake in the name of the Lord. Blessed we call them, or behold, we call them blessed rather, that endure. Ye have heard of the patience of Job, and have seen the end of the Lord, how that the Lord is full of pity and merciful." Now, in that brief statement, the inspired writer James puts his mark of approval on the whole book of Job. He sums the whole book up as Job is one that suffered and became an example of patience. Furthermore, we note that the Apostle Paul was well familiar with the writings of Job. As you turn in your Bible to 1 Corinthians chapter 3, 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and read verse 19, beginning at verse 18. He said, "Let no man deceive himself. If any man thinketh that he is wise among you in this world, let him become a fool, that he may become wise. For the wisdom of the world is foolishness with God, for it is written, He that taketh the wise in their craftiness, and again, the Lord knoweth the reasonings of the wise, that they are vain." Now that first quotation that Paul gives here, it says, "It is written." That's from Job chapter 5, verse 13. What does that tell you about Paul's knowledge of the book of Job? It's inspired. He quotes from it. And you'll notice another quote in Romans chapter 11 and verse 35. And you can compare that with Job chapter 41. No, not Psalms. I've tried that. It's not in Psalms 41. It's in Job 41 and in verse 11 where that quotation comes from. Now, I say that for this reason. Paul was well familiar with the writings of Job and authenticates and approves the book by quoting it in the New Testament. Now, having said that, regarding the historical background of the book of Job, this I find intriguing. And from my own personal opinion, and that's essentially what it is, I'm convinced that the character Job, his place in history, is perhaps during the time of the patriarchal period. And there's some reasons for that. One is that there's no mention in the book of Job regarding the law. There's no book, no mention in the book of Job regarding the law of Moses, the covenant, the priesthood, the sacrifices under the law, and so forth. Yet it's obvious that Job is well acquainted with what sin is. But it was outside the scope of the law of Moses. Nothing referred to in that. And there is no mention of the nation of Israel. In fact, if you look on a map, you'll note that the places that are attributed to be the homes of Job's friends are outside the land of Israel. Now, exactly where, I don't know, to be honest, but we note that the Chaldeans were over here, and they're mentioned as those in Job chapter 1, the Chaldeans and the Sabaeans that smote the house of the sons, or smote the herds and flocks, of Job, and took them away and killed the servants with the edge of the sword. And later, of course, in history, they became a mighty empire here around the Euphrates and the Tigris River. This is the area where Abraham was from. And I find, just looking at a map, that to be interesting in terms of accounting for the great wealth that Job obviously had. When you turn back to the book of Job in the first chapter, it tells us in verse 3 that his substance also was 7,000 sheep, 300,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses, and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the children of the East. Now that's revealing, because it tells us that he was of the East, and this area around the Euphrates River and the Tigris River was the most fertile in the area at the time. So it would seem likely that the place of Job is over in this area, in the eastern part of what we have on the map, now known, located as Mesopotamia, the Chaldeans, and the Assyrian area, of where Job may have lived during this time. Now, I want to back up just a little bit, go back to this chart. There's no mention of the tabernacle in the book of Job. No mention of the temple or the altar in the city of Jerusalem in the book of Job. Now, some just explain that away and say, well, Job was a Gentile, so none of that's mentioned. Well, now, we know that there were prophets that were sent among Gentiles. We know that so when we read, for example, the book of Nahum, when we read the book of Jonah. We're reading books that are addressed to those who were not Israelites. And as we read those books, yes, we know that there were those who existed who were from Gentile backgrounds, who had some communication and relationship with God. Now, whether that's so with Job or not, I don't much think so. It's my opinion that it was before the nation of Israel that Job lived, that would perhaps put him during the time frame somewhere around the time of Abraham. Now, be that as it may, there's no reason to be dogmatic about that. But one of the things that we do know is that during this time, as we mentioned, the Chaldeans and the Sabaeans are represented as robbers, looters, or bandits as they came upon the flocks and the herds of Job and took it all away and killed the servants. Well, that was characteristic of these people before they became such mighty and powerful nations. History will help us somewhat with that. Another thing that we need to note just here is that Job serves in the priestly capacity. You'll notice in the first chapter there in verse 5, it tells us that it was so when the days of their feasting were gone about that Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and renounced God in their hearts. Thus did Job continually. Job is serving as a priest. Now, if we're talking about the relationship to the law, then of course that would make him an Israelite and there would be a separate priesthood. So it's unlikely that to be the case. Secondly, we want to note that in the book of Job, he repudiates the worship of either the sun or the moon. And you can read that in Job chapter 31. But worship of the sun and the moon was not especially unique, but it existed during the time of Abraham. And this unit of money, I don't know how much that was worth, but it's mentioned in Job chapter 42. And it occurs only here. And then in Genesis chapter 43, again, we want to call your attention to the patriarchal period of time. Another thing I find interesting about this, as we're trying to plug it into a time frame in history, And that is the longevity of Job corresponds to the age of the patriarchs. You'll note that Job lived 140 years more after he lost everything and his body was smitten with boils from the top of his head to the sole of his foot. God blessed him with double measure of what he had before. But he lived a long time after he suffered the loss of those things. So it would be correct to come to the conclusion that Job endured a very long, long life. Long enough to accumulate all of this wealth, and then to lose it in an instant of time, and then eventually to gain it back. Some other things that we want to note here. Where is the land of Uz? We're told in verse 1 that that's where Job was from. I've said about all I know to say about that. I don't know. He's from the east. That's all we know. Probably somewhere around the city of Damascus, between the Tigris and the Euphrates River in that area. Later, we learn that this land would fall under the judgment of God. The Edomites lived in that land, according to Jeremiah's writing in Lamentation chapter 4 and verse 21. Other locations are proposed for the land of Uz, but it would be in that area, east of the land that was given to the nation of Israel. Now, who was Job? Here again, don't know. Don't know who he was. But here's what we know about him. We know that he's referred to as a perfect and an upright man, a man that feared God and turned away from evil. We know that he was very wealthy. In fact, that this man was the greatest of all the children of the East. We know that he offered sacrifices, as we read in verse 5, and we know that this was typical of his life. He did this, the text tells us, continually. And in chapter 1, verse 8, it says, "There is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and turneth away from evil." Now that says all we need to know about who Job was. Now, here's the issue. Introduced in the very first chapter. Doth God or doth Job serve God for naught? Now, as we look through and study the book, there are some things I want you to look for. I want you to look at the reasoning of Job. Why is he perplexed? We'll have more on that in just a moment. But we're going to see that Job and his friends operate under a false premise. Their premise is that all suffering is punishment for something that we've done that's wrong. Now, all suffering is not punishment. Job had to finally learn that. But he began with the same premise that even his friends began with. That's why he's so disturbed and perplexed. What have I done to cause all this to come upon me? So, God said, "He's in your hand. You do what you will." And one of the things that we want to note, we noted this last time, and we want to reiterate it for the setting that we're about to study. Satan is allowed to act, but he's not allowed to act without any boundaries. God said, "You can do this," and that's all. Now, when God said, "You can take away all of the things that he has," we note that Satan had the use of the instrumentality of men. You'll notice in this first chapter, beginning in verse 14, it tells us that there came a messenger unto Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them away. They have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee." Well, what we know is that Satan could use the instrumentality of these evil men to accomplish his purposes. We know that he could use the instrumentality of the forces of nature. When you drop down in that text to about verse 18, it tells us, "While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, Thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee." Now what we want to note in that is that Satan was able to use even what some have referred to as tornado or cyclone or something to that effect to blow away the house of the children of Job. And we know that Satan was able to smite Job's body with boils from the top of his head to the sole of his foot. And one of the things that we want to note about that is how bad that was. When you turn over to the seventh chapter, I believe it is, and in verse 5, chapter 7, verse 5, there it tells us, "My flesh is clothed with worms and clods of dust. My skin closeth up and breaketh out afresh." Here is a very vivid description of the sores that characterized Job's body. The worms had infested it, was infected as he took a broken piece of pottery to rake out the infection. Sitting in the city ash heap, as it were, Job's wife has said, "Curse God and die." He still maintains his integrity. We note that society has rejected him. They don't have anything to do with him. In Job chapter 17 and in verse 6, Job chapter 17 and in verse 6, the writer says, "He hath made me a byword of the people, and they spit in my face. Mine eye also is dim by reason of sorrow, and all my members are as a shadow. Upright men shall be astonished at this, and the innocent shall stir up himself against the godless." What we're reading is that society looked upon Job as an outcast because of the condition that he was in. And then, of course, in Job chapter 2, we've noted already, in verses 11 through verse 13, the disbelief even of Job's wife as she said, "Curse God and die." Now, here we are back to our question. Doth Job fear God for naught? Why do the righteous suffer? Can God trust man to serve him for nothing? Serving simply because it's right. And then, can man trust God when he is in the most intense and dire of circumstances, and he doesn't understand, he can't explain it? Can man trust God to be there when he's suffering so intensely? Well, now these are questions that are answered in the book of Job. Very serious questions that I believe help us in our life. Now, if you would please, let's look at Eliphaz and note just for a moment some facts about his first speech. And oh, by the way, in the notes that you have in your lap, you'll turn over to the back page, very back last thing, and you'll notice a brief outline of the book of Job. I wanted you to have that because as you're reading from the book of Job, it would be helpful to see where each speaker speaks and what Job's answer is, so you can go to the passage readily and read that and have somewhat of an outline as you're reading and studying through the book of Job. But in Eliphaz's first speech in Job chapter 4, Eliphaz, he takes the position that suffering, all suffering, is the result of sin. Now, Job, you're suffering, therefore, you're a sinner. Now, that's his argument. All suffering is the result of sin. And so, Job, here's where you are. The conclusion is, you've committed some grievous wrong. Now, when you look at the text of Job chapter 4, and note beginning in verse 3, we commented on this just briefly in our last study. He says, "Behold, thou hast instructed many, and hast strengthened the weak hands. Thy words have upholden him that was falling, and thou hast made firm the feeble knees. But now it is come to thee, and thou faintest. It toucheth thee, and thou art troubled. Is not thy fear of God thy confidence, and the integrity of thy ways thy hope? Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished, being innocent. Or where were the upright cut off?" Now you see his question. Innocent folks don't suffer. Job, you're suffering. Therefore, you can't be innocent. You must be guilty. Now that's what he has to say in the beginning portions of the first chapter. And we also noted in our last study that he attributes his argumentation from his experiences. "This is what I've seen." And here's what has been revealed to me in verse 12, secretly in a dream. So, Job, the things I'm telling you, they're accurate because, you see, I've experienced that and I've had a dream about that. Now, how many have reasoned that way? Such foolishness. And here's Job's friend come to comfort him with such argumentation. Now, in his second speech, we again see somewhat of a syllogism that is presented. If you'll turn to the 15th chapter of the book of Job, in verse 2, Eliphaz said, "Should a wise man make answer with vain knowledge and fill himself with the east wind? Should he reason with unprofitable talk or with speeches wherewith he can do no good? Yea, thou doest away with fear and hinderest devotion before God, for thine iniquity teacheth thy mouth, and thou choosest the tongue of the crafty. Thine own mouth condemneth thee, and not I. Yea, thine own lips testify against thee." Do we not see that Eliphaz is making an argument? His argument is, you're in trouble, Job, because of your confidence. You're arrogant, and because of that, here's what's come upon you. Now, his argument is that only those who are wicked suffer. They're cut off. And Job, you've been cut off. Therefore, Job, you've got to be an awful, awful man. Now, that's his reasoning as he begins in chapter 14. Look at verse 20. He said, "The wicked man travaileth with pain all his days, even the number of years that are laid up for the oppressor. A sound of terrors is in his ear. In prosperity, the destroyer shall come upon him. He believeth not that he shall return out of darkness, and he that is waited for of the sword. He wandereth abroad for bread, saying, Where is it? He knoweth that the day of darkness is ready at his hand. Distress and anguish make him afraid." Job, all this is happening to you. Therefore, Job, you're an awful fellow. Now, old Eliphaz, he just is unrelenting. In Job chapter 22, we read his third speech. And once again, he charges Job with great wickedness, appealing to Job, just go ahead and confess what it is that you have done. Now Job asked him, "Well, if I'm going to confess what I've done, then tell me what I've done." Now that would seem reasonable, wouldn't it? Look at verse 4. He said, "Is it for thy fear?" Now here's Job. "Is it for thy fear of him that he reproveth thee? He that entereth with thee into judgment. Is not thy wickedness great? Neither is there any end to thine iniquities. For thou hast taken pledges of thy brother for naught, and stripped the naked of their clothing, and hast not given water to the weary to drink, and thou hast withholden bread from the hungry. But as for the mighty man, he had the earth. The honorable man, he dwelt therein. You've seen widows, and you've sent them away empty. Job, here's what you've done." Well, now, Eliphaz just don't cut him any slack at all, does he? "You're a wicked man. This is what you've done. You're suffering because you have committed sin." Well, when we read Bildad's first speech is just horrible. And it gets worse. He doesn't cut Job any slack either. In the 8th chapter of the book of Job, the 8th chapter beginning in verse 1, Bildad the Shuhite said, "How long wilt thou speak these things?" In other words, Job, if you'll notice in the previous chapters, he's tried to defend himself, to reveal the horror that he experiences from the suffering. And Bildad's question is, "How long are you going to maintain your integrity? How long are you going to say, I'm innocent, I haven't done anything?" He said in verse 2, as he continues, "How long shall the words of thy mouth be like a mighty wind? Doth God pervert justice?" And then in verse 4, "If thy children have sinned against him, and he hath delivered them into the hand of the transgressor, their transgression, if thou wouldest seek diligently unto God and make thy supplication to the Almighty, then everything would be fine," you see. But the problem is, you've sinned, your children have sinned, and all of this has come upon you because you're terrible. Now that would be a lot of comfort, wouldn't it? In the 18th chapter, we read Bildad's second speech, where he depicts the awful lot of those who are sinners. Now here's his premise. The lot of sinners is terrible. So you suffer because you're a sinner. And Job, your lot is terrible. So you see where his conclusion comes from. Now that's the kind of reasoning that these friends are subjecting Job to, and Zophar. I never cease to be amazed when I read Zophar's argumentation. In Job chapter 11, he is the most dogmatic of the three fellows that argue against Job. And you'll note his argument begins in verse 2, "Should not the multitude of words be answered? And should a man full of talk be justified? Should thy boastings make men hold their peace? And when thou mockest, shall a man make thee ashamed? For thou sayest, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in thine eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against thee, and that he would show thee the secrets of wisdom. For he is manifold in understanding. Know therefore that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserveth." Well, that's profound, isn't it? Zophar, why, what you're suffering is not even close to what you've earned. You deserve to lose a whole lot more than what you've lost. Now, to the credit of Zophar, he does make one concession in his speeches, and you'll turn over to the 20th chapter of the book of Job. And note with me, if you would, there, beginning in verse 1. It says, "Then answered Zophar the Naamathite, and said, therefore do my thoughts give answer to me, even by reason of my haste that is in me. I have heard the reproof which putteth me to shame, and the spirit of mine understanding answereth me. Knowest thou not this of old time, since man was placed upon the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the godless but for a moment?" So if you're a good fellow, Job, the good things won't last long. But if you're an evil fellow, the bad things won't last long. Now that's comforting, isn't it? I tell you, with friends like that, as we say, who needs enemies? And all of this, three points stand out. And I want us to look at these. Why is Job so disturbed? Job affirms his integrity. "I am innocent." Now I want us to underscore that Job does not claim perfection. But what he is claiming is that the suffering that I am enduring is not merited by the things that I've done. There's just no comparison between the two. Job recognizes, yes, he's an upright man. He's a righteous man. But he's not denying that he's ever committed sin. Job says, "I'm innocent." He's undergoing terrible things, awful, beyond even description. And in every instant, Job seeks answers from God. And you know the thing that may impress us as we read through the book of Job? God doesn't say a word to Job until we get to chapter 38. That's a long, long time into the sufferings of Job. He's asking, why? Why? And he's not getting any response. And then when he does get a response, in Job chapter 38, you'll notice that God does not tell him why. I find that to be perplexing. When you suffer things and you don't know why, you don't see any justification. You just don't know why. And you keep asking and you keep asking. And there's no reply about what you've done to merit this kind of suffering. And you see why Job is perplexed. What awful things he is suffering. But there's not anything that comes to his mind, or any specific thing that is introduced by anyone else that would justify the magnitude of his suffering. He keeps going to God and asking why. Why should his suffering be so intense? Now, we say Job was a righteous man, but even righteous Job, in all of this circumstance and perplexity that is upon him, is greatly disturbed. In the 6th chapter of the book of Job, Job says in verse 14. To him that is ready to faint kindness should be showed from his friend, even to him that forsaketh the fear of the Almighty. My brethren have dealt deceitfully as a brook, as the channel of brooks pass away. Dropping down further in that text, he said, did I say give to me or offer a present for me of your substance or deliver me from the adversary's hand or redeem me from the hand of the oppressors? No, Job didn't ask for any of those things. What he asked for was some kind of an explanation where he could have some kind of peace. In verse 24, he said, teach me and I will hold my peace and cause me to understand wherein I have erred. I want to know, God, what have I done to cause these awful things to come upon me? And then in verse 30, he said, is there injustice on my tongue? Cannot my taste discern mischievous things? In other words, can't I understand things that are right and wrong? Is there something amiss here that I'm not seeing? And then as you drop down further into the ninth chapter, perhaps the most grievous accusation against God is found in this context. The words of Job. Look in Job chapter 9, reading beginning at verse 20. Verse 20. He says, though I be righteous, mine own mouth shall condemn me. Though I be perfect, it shall prove me perverse. I am perfect, I regard not myself. I despise my life. Now we want to note that word perfect. He's not claiming sinlessness. He's claiming simply to be righteous. But he says, I despise my life. Look at all of the things that I've endured. And why? In verse 22, read on. It is all one, therefore I say, he destroyeth the perfect and the wicked. Who said that? Job did. Who's he talking about? He's talking about God. There's just no justice here. God destroys the perfect and the wicked. If the scourge lays suddenly, he will mock at the trial of the innocent. That's a pretty serious indictment of God. And then in verse 24, the earth is given to the hand of the wicked. He covereth the faces of the judges thereof. If it be not he, who then is it? You see, Job is saying very simply, if God's not behind all this, then I don't know who he is. Now that's a very serious charge against God, but Job is correct when he said, if God's not behind it, I don't know who is. He did not know what we sometimes refer to as the preface of the circumstance, the issue where Satan and God have this conversation. Job's unaware of that. So no, he don't know the source. He's blaming God with injustice. I don't know why this has come up on me. Now admittedly, all power belongs to God. But it appears as if God uses it to further the cause of the bad as well as the good. And you can read about that in the 12th chapter. Now in this, Job, he's just wrong. He's accusing God of being unjust, and God is not unjust. He doesn't understand some things that later he will come to understand. That is, God does not have to explain everything to his satisfaction and to his understanding. Now in verses or chapters 13 and 19 through that context, Job's attitude kind of begins to change. Now I looked at the clock a while ago. We might need to pause right here. This would be a good place for us to put it on hold and pick up next time and see that Job's attitude does begin to change somewhat as he reasons that a godless man shall not come before him. He raises the question, what are my sins? And why do you hide your face from me? Why? And then this statement gives us pause. Wilt thou harass a driven leaf? And wilt thou pursue the dry stubble? Here's Job over here. He claims his innocency. And so the question is, would you torment something that's just as innocent as a leaf falling in the wind? And Job appeals to God to witness on his behalf. And I want you to note, as you read further into the 19th chapter, the confidence of Job. Job is confident that God will make everything all right, that God will announce him to be innocent, that God will vindicate him. But his suffering is not right. It's unjust. And my friend, when we begin to pursue from there, we'll see more. But I think it becomes very enlightening. I mentioned to someone earlier in preparation for some of these lessons that when you study or just simply are reading the book of Job, it just kind of draws you into it. It's difficult to put it down. There's a lot of valuable lessons to learn in the argumentation of Job's friend, and the argumentation of Job, and we didn't get to the argumentation of Zophar. We'll have to talk about that at another time. But what we want to learn is that all suffering is not the result of doing something wrong. All suffering is not in the sense of being punished for something you've done that's wrong. And so Job and Job's friends, they start with the wrong premise. Now I want you to look at one statement, and then we'll close our study. When you go back to the initial chapters, chapter 1 and chapter 2 of the book of Job, and see Job's response to his suffering, he said, "Jehovah gave, and Jehovah hath taken away. Blessed be the name of Jehovah." And you'll see that later. Jehovah has given, and Jehovah has taken away. When Job's wife said, "Curse God and die," he said, "You speak as one of the foolish women. What, shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? Jehovah giveth, Jehovah taketh away." Now I want to ask you, as you contemplate your studies for next Sunday night, was Job's statement altogether accurate? God gave, and God took it away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I want to suggest to you that in one sense, what Job has said is right. But in another sense, what Job has said is not right. He's reasoning just like his friends are. That the things that he's suffering is punishment by God, that God took it away. No. See, again, Job was not aware of the conversation that God had had with Satan. And so his reasoning is skewed by the thinking of men, just like his friends. Jehovah gave and Jehovah took it away. Well, in some respects, yes. In some respects, no. Depends on what perspective you're looking at that. And so we want to talk about that some more as our study pursues. Thank you for your attention this evening. Now, as you know, this lesson is, as we study the book of Job, it's not designed to instruct somebody what to do to be a Christian. That's not the nature of the book. It's given to teach us how to deal with suffering. But suppose you're here tonight and you understand that you're separated from God because of your sin. It's your desire to do something about that. You believe that Jesus is the Christ. You're determined to turn from the things that are wrong. Perhaps it's your desire tonight to confess your faith and be baptized. Everything is ready so that you can be identified as a child of God by your obedience to the gospel of Christ. Maybe you've obeyed the gospel and your life is not what it needs to be. Perhaps you've searched yourself and unlike Job, you cannot claim I'm innocent. You know what you've done. You want to correct that. If we can help you this evening by praying with you and for you to that end, that's certainly our desire. If you be subject to the invitation in any way, let us know. While together we stand and sing this song.